Welcome, everyone, and thanks for joining us today. I think we're all looking forward to your testimony. Again, just as a reminder, your testimony shouldn't be any longer than 5 minutes so that we have more time for questions and answers. And I'm going to start with one of my introductions, and then we'll be switching back and forth, Ranking Member Johans and myself. Want to tell you how pleased I am to see Don Keeley, Executive Director of the Red River Regional Council in Grafton, North Dakota, which is a town north of Grand Forks. Don has over 23 years of community and economic development experience, serving as the Executive Director of the Red River Regional Council, a multi-county regional council located in northeastern North Dakota, assisting local government in economic and community development, disaster recovery, housing development, and rehabilitation and strategic planning. She's been heavily involved in all aspects of rural development in her community and in her region. She and her husband, John, and their beautiful children have a farm north of Grafton that I've been fortunate enough to be a guest at, and you certainly are among the best of rural development leaders all across the country, and I thank you so much for attending. Senator Johans will introduce Mr. Pearson.
Garrett Pearson has served Sidney, Nebraska as city manager for the past 15 years. He grew up on a small farm and a ranch on the Wyoming-Nebraska border, graduated from the University of Nebraska at Kearney in Western Nebraska Community College. Gary manages a $31 million annual budget, 81 full-time and 30 part-time employees, and oversees and manages 13 city departments. I can tell you from personal experience, Gary has provided inspired leadership and energetic ideas to transform a community that is a real success story, really throughout the Midwest. His unwavering belief in the goodness and the strength of rural America, specifically rural Nebraska, helped lay the groundwork for what has become a booming economy in that part of the state. Gary, I look forward to hearing your thoughts. I thank you for being here today, and to all of our other panelists, let me say also, welcome.
Our third panelist, Mr. Tilson, has been very ably introduced by our senator from South Dakota, but I want to welcome him personally. He is the president of Native American Natural Foods. He has more than 25 years of experience in nonprofit fundraising, marketing, community development, and 18 years in special event marketing and production. Obviously received in a tremendous number of awards, but I want to personally tell you, I took your bars on a long hike in Peru and shared them with a lot of people who thought they were pretty darn good. I think that your efforts and your products are well known all across within that outdoors community, and congratulations on the many awards your products have received. Our finalist panelist is Chuck Fluharty. He's the founder and president of Rural Policy Research Institute. He's widely recognized as an expert on regional strategies and rural economic development, and has been involved in numerous regional planning efforts throughout our country. It is the only national policy institute in the United States of America solely dedicated to assisting rural impacts and looking at public policy and rural impact, rural communities. This comprehensive approach to rural policy analysis involves faculty from founding member institutes at Iowa State, the University of Missouri, the University of Nebraska, as well as researchers, policy analysts, practitioners from other universities, research institutions, governments, and non-government organizations. Don, we'll begin with you. I want to begin your testimony now.
Thank you very much.
You press the button.
Heidi Heidkamp and Ranking Member Johans and the members of the subcommittee, I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today and discuss the importance of regional development strategies. As Senator Heitkamp said, I am the executive director of the Red River Regional Council. I have been part of this organization since about 1993. I took a five-year hiatus and went to work for a private engineering firm. And in that experience, I was highly involved in the oil patch in North Dakota and dealing with regional strategies in Western North Dakota to address rapid growth issues, which is just a flip side of much of what we've historically dealt with. We serve to unite and collaborate with all of the cities in our region, and I am currently under the development of our regional economic development strategy. So I've been holding those meetings locally in the last few weeks and months, and to try to figure out what our regional strategy is and updating that. And I've gotten very impressive engagement and involvement in those discussions. The things I really want to talk about today, I wanted to bring up three key points that I think are very important as it relates to regional strategies and what will make that happen well in our as a practitioner and amongst my colleagues here. The first one is leverage. I like to say the leverage is our middle name in rural America. We have to leverage on every front on all days. Leverage in our volunteer base, leverage with our communities and our partners. And I jest that our private and public sector partners are our capital SWAT team, capital with an A. And so when I have a really great project that I need to bring forward, I call in the SWAT team and they show up and we get the job done. And I've been very impressed by that. I think we have a very can-do spirit amongst our economic development personnel and leaders in North Dakota, our state and federal leaders. So our tagline is moving ideas to action. So I'm all about action. I want to get things done, and that requires leveraging and having strong partnerships with all the parties involved. The Regional Council is one of those local partners that the Undersecretary referenced as well. We manage multiple federal grants. We currently have at least seven contracts in place with different federal agencies, either directly or indirectly. Maintaining the program funding for some of these federal relationships is very important to our agency. Without that funding, we have a small staff of six people, and without these key funding elements, we would not even be able to maintain our staff. The second key foundation is really the ability to integrate programs. And we talk about leverage, we need to also be able to integrate programs. Amongst our staff, we have staff that have to have expertise in multiple areas and are funded in multiple ways. So we are always integrating our programs and trying to be innovative in our approaches on how we can even explain to our state and federal partners how that we can make this all work better together. One of the difficult parts of some of the leverage and program integration that we do is the requirement of the federal approved indirect cost plan. And for a small agency such as ours to develop the cost plan and regularly update it on an annual basis, it does become an issue. And so there are occasions where many of the federal programs require one-to-one match, which can be a struggle to meet the match requirements. But we also then, if we don't have that federally approved indirect rate, then we are further subsidizing those programs with about another 20 to 25% of our humble office setting requirements. So the SBA does have a policy where they have an indirect rate that they've provided through the agency. So I would recommend that be considered for most of the federal programs on these smaller awards. The last piece is really about strong, vibrant rural communities, and I'm running low on time, so I'll try to hit some hot spots here. But the agriculture is very important in rural North Dakota. It's 25% of our employment base as well as 25% of our economic base. And since 1940, 30 of our 53 rural communities have had 70 years of decline population. So I like to say I really have given this a lot of thought, and I really think that the efficiencies gained in the farm economy have also led to the demise of our small rural communities. So while the farm has grown, the communities have shrunk. And I'm looking at my children and wondering how I'm going to be able to keep my children interested in staying in this rural community. And also the ability that farms have become very high tech. And these high-tech farms can't be supported by low-tech low-amenity communities. And in our regional planning efforts today, we're losing 30% of that age group. We've lost between the ages of 0 to 44, we've lost 30% in the last decade alone. So we have some real struggles and challenges. I would like to put a plug real quick that today we are inspiring youth entrepreneurship. And as I speak, there's 600 kids gathered in the school district in Grafton talking about youth entrepreneurship all day long. So this is hopefully one of our first building blocks to move forward and inspiring our youth to use their technology skills to build these communities. So thank you.
Thanks, Don. Mr. Pearson.
Thank you, Chairwoman Heitkamp, Ranking Member and our favorite son from Nebraska, Senator Johans, other members of the committee. It's an honor to be here. Though I come before you with the title of city manager, I'm still about as grassroots country boy as it gets. I've spent my adult life trying to find the keys to sustainability and meeting the challenges a rural community faces in America's heartland. I'm the first generation on both sides of my family that no longer is involved in farming and ranching. The farming and ranching way of life we grew up with has practically disappeared from today's landscape, but the preservation of rural lifestyles and values is still critically important for America's future well-being. In Nebraska, 80 of our 93 counties are considered non-metro. It amazes me in those 80 rural counties there was more population in the 1890 census than in the 2010 census, and only six have shown population growth since 1950. Rural communities all across America have struggled to survive as their way of life has changed dramatically. Drive down any of their main streets, your eyes will tell you everything. Take a leisurely drive on a country road and abandoned farmsteads far outnumber those inhabited. The average age of the population has nearly reached senior citizen status. Most rural communities won't and simply can't survive if they have not diversified the agriculture revenue stream that is their primary economy. Today, I share a story about one community that found new ways of sustainability, economic diversification, and completely reinvented itself over the past 40 years. It's not a suburb that pretends it's a small community, as it's 100 miles from any population base and 350 miles from the state capital. Our community was thriving in the 1940s and 50s, but its primary payrolls were dominated by the federal government and Mother Nature. You simply can't control either one as a small rural community. By 1970, most of those jobs disappeared and farming and ranching was about to head into the 1980s crisis mode. Population declined 45 consecutive years, the economy tanked, and public infrastructure started to erode away. In the most recent 25 years, four times we have taken economic development initiatives to a vote of the people, and each time the citizens overwhelmingly voted to rebuild their own future, not depend on someone else to do it for them. We educated ourselves on federal and state revitalization programs that would give us a hand up, not a handout. We did it with homegrown entrepreneurs like the Cabela's family, with its national outfitter reputation and our own knack for recruiting other employers across the country looking to expand into a rural lifestyle. Even into the 1990s, agriculture had always been the largest industry earner in our local economy. Today, it ranks as our seventh leading industry earner. We've tripled that local economy and valuation base over the last 20 years. We have more jobs per capita than almost any community in America. Every one of our employers need more workers. We have another $300 million in new projects on the ground and moving forward this spring. Our most significant challenge is building affordable workforce housing. Today's new generation is not pulled by the rural emotional heartstrings like those of us who grew up in rural America. They will, however, come back for good jobs, quality of life, and a safe place to raise their families. Our employers have proven it. I'm sharing several statistics provided by the Public Affairs Research Center for the University of Nebraska-Omaha, illustrating the rural outmigration of our state, where 75% of our 93 counties lost population again just this past decade. I've also provided key excerpts from our 2012 City Comprehensive Plan on how we have bucked that trend and diversified our economy. Some of the suggestions I mentioned in the written testimony, I realize you have no control over in this subcommittee, but I sense what you are all about is the general awareness and future well-being of rural America. There are ways you can influence those outcomes in arenas beyond this committee with a shift in policy and an elimination of bureaucracy. One of the key advantages rural America had a generation ago was its low cost of utilities and housing. The same is not true today. Our small community has had to endure $20 million of mandated public infrastructure projects, primarily brought on by the increased environmental regulations dealing with water, wastewater, landfill, electrical generation sources, emission standards, and others. Combined with new banking regulations, it will put many small communities out of business and lock the door for any hope of a future rural renaissance. Regional emphasis is critically important, but it's going to take incentivizing communities and counties to work together to have the impact we must have to achieve consolidation, break down longstanding barriers, and begin to work on regional strategies. USDA programs are critically important to help us balance this ever-growing regulatory world with low-interest long-term financing and guaranteed loans for projects in the public and private sectors. We also need more flexibility within those programs on income standards. I believe, like you do, that rural America still matters. We just need to have Americans rediscover this opportunity and way of life once again. Thank you for your dedicated service to our country.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Mr. Tilson?
I'd like to thank Senator Thune for that rather gracious introduction. I only want to make one correction is I'm not a tribal member. I'm a new guy there. All my kids and grandchildren are tribal members, but I've only been there for 40 years. I'd also like to thank Chairwoman Heidekamp and other distinguished members of the committee. I'm here today as the co-founder and president of Native American Natural Foods. I've worked on and around the Pine Ridge Reservation for about 30 years. Pine Ridge is well known as one of the poorest places in America where the unemployment rate has never been higher, never been lower than 65%. This 30 plus years of work has given me a firsthand knowledge of the impact of our federal government's economic development programs in Indian Country, and I'll try to share with you today. As the father of three children who are members of the tribe and six grandchildren, it is their future that motivates me and whose interests I represent here today. I know that I'm also a social entrepreneur who believes that at this critical time in history, we must and can build sustainable, just economies that preserve our air, water, and land. I know that each and every business decision we make has to focus on what is best for the greater good for our grandchildren, yours and mine alike. As social entrepreneurs, we look at business as a tool to address social needs. We operate on more than just the financial bottom line, and we listen to the market for opportunity to create change. This is why my business partner, Carlene Hunter, and I launched Native American Natural Foods. We created a national brand in the middle of a food desert in one of the most geographically, economically isolated places in America on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. We did this with purpose and intention. We understood the social problems, the poverty, the barriers to business success. We live with them every day. So we chose to focus on the positive assets in our community. We wanted to see if we could build a brand that could one day become strong enough to break the isolation of the reservation and to have a positive impact on the health of the people, the land, and the buffalo. This led us to an idea. Could we take the Lakota people's ancestral knowledge of the perfect portable energy food and create a new brand that shared the positive history of healthy food, stewardship of the land, air, water, and respect for the buffalo as the givers of life and turn it into a high-value natural brand? Then we took the entrepreneurial step of putting everything at risk and created the Tonka Bar. Today, I'm proud to share with you that the Tonka Bar is sold on over 375 Indian reservations, over 6,000 retailers, including Whole Foods, Costco, Natural Grocers, National Parks, and many, many more. We've created a learning company that is focused on quality natural products, best-in-class customer service, empowering our employees to become owners. We are an innovator of a new category in this emerging category of meat bar snacks. We have created the category only over seven years ago. The Tonka Bar is the first protein bar with real meat in it, the first meat snack with real fruit, and the only 100% buffalo fruit bar. We are also the only certified Native American natural product that is distributed nationally. And as you said, we've won many national awards. We're a mission-driven company. We've created 9 full-time jobs on the reservation. When we started, none of our employees had ever worked in the natural food industry. But given the opportunity tied with training, tools to succeed, and our employees are now on track to become managers and soon owners of the company. We have created a profitable business model, but we have only begun to have our desired impact on the community. Our next step is we need to refinance for growth, expand our product offering, increase our investments in marketing, invest in management level training, and grow the number of Native American buffalo. We need to recruit more young people into raising buffalo, as it's a fast-growing opportunity. In order to address this, we have joined forces with the American Indian Land Tenure Foundation to launch the Tonka Fund. It's a new national campaign to return buffalo to the lives, lands, and economy of Indian people. It is critical that we find a way for USDA to play an important role in bringing the buffalo back into the economy. The challenges of lack of basic infrastructure, shortfalls of capital, training resources, inadequate, undependable internet, access to land and markets for Native American natural foods are many. But we are a microcosm of the bigger challenge facing Native American communities. I want to jump ahead to point out that the Ogallala Sioux Tribe with the Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation has completed a regional plan. And they've created a regional plan for sustainability, and they've created a roadmap to do this. We're one of the few companies that was able to participate fully in the creation of this regional plan. But then the regional plan isn't funded. So it's another example of what happens when, you know, you have a lot of young people. Over 23 organizations participated in this, but but we're not even close to recognizing the needs. The plan shows that every single community on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation is at capacity. And I want to point out that we have 11 of the poorest counties in the United States in South Dakota. And these are all Native American communities. And the thing that is different than the challenges we have is the population in the Native communities is growing faster than anywhere else. It's the only rural communities in our state that are growing. But it's estimated that the Ogallala Sioux Tribe lacks over 5,000 houses. The current HUD funding for houses is not even enough to keep up with the current growth of the population. In whether it's current infrastructure, housing, expanding infrastructure, there's severe shortfall that this new regional planning initiative is really critical for the next step for our business, but the bigger community. And we're not just an isolated business. We cannot succeed and grow without the necessary infrastructure. And did I just go over my time?
But it was going so well, we didn't say anything.
I'll just keep going then. Yeah, no. I guess that's my biggest point, is that the average age in Indian country is about 25. People are returning to the reservation, but we're not investing in the future, the hopes, the dreams of these young people. And the opportunity is tremendous, but the gap between what is available to them and what is needed is just enormous. As an interested observer to federal programs, I've seen many, many of these types of projects where you get the community excited, there's a lot of research, a lot of planning, but then on the federal level, the follow-through is not there. And we're hopeful that this new change in the Farm Bill is going to open up the opportunity to help meet that need. I also want to point out that one of the biggest changes that I think could add to success of entrepreneurial development in Indian country is start to back away from grants and figure out a way to allow people to earn equity. That's what we're doing with our company. If we're going to talk about wealth creation, we have to get beyond job creation, and we have to figure out a way to provide equity. I think equity will have a bigger multiplier effect on the local economy. In the long term, it'll have a better impact on the national debt. And it's really necessary for the next step, which means we're going to have to take more risk. We might have to balance that with the accountability, but we do have to figure out a way to take more risk. I guess my last thing I just want to say is that climate change is no longer a debate. The only decision left will be, will you, our elected leaders, have the courage to lead us to a new sustainable economy? We realize that the economic forces to maintain the status quo may seem stronger than gravity itself, but change can happen. The majority of people support it. Native communities across South Dakota are unified in their opposition to uranium mining in the Black Hills and the XL energy fight. But we often ignore Native communities when they stand with the water and land. And in fact, we've punished them both economically and politically for their position to protect air, water, and land. And I think we now need to take a step back and learn from them. That's what we're doing with our company. And I'd like to urge you as our leaders to do the same.
Thank you, Mr. Tilson. Mr. Fluharty.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And congratulations to you. Ranking Member Johans and members of the subcommittee, Senator Casey, I'll try to be quick. I know you have a vote coming. It's an honor to be here today, particularly with three world-class practitioners. And if you just listen to these three individuals, I think the roadmap's fairly clear. I would ask that my comments be in the record. I want to say I'm very pleased to be here today to not talk about my request that you create a regional strategy in a farm bill. Today, I want to commend this committee for your vision, for your acknowledgement of the practical realities in the countryside, and for creating legislation that I think is potentially the most significant entrepreneurial development since the RD title was put in the Farm Bill. I want to thank you for that opportunity you've created for our rural young people to stay where they live. But I also want to urge your vigilance. I want to urge your commitment, and I want to urge your oversight. I'd like to make three points in that regard. You have to assure your legislative intent reaches its full potential. Secondly, the goals that you have created this program for have to be followed closely, and we need an evidence base to assure when we come back to the next bill, you have a rationale to continue it, deepen it, fund it more deeply. As my colleague just said, the need is very, very great, and the follow-through federally is a challenge still. Finally, we need to make certain this is exploited by the department, and that's critical. This will require some things. It's going to demand your patience, it's going to demand flexibility, and it's going to demand collaboration. This is hard work. Soft infrastructure takes time and great people. You're going to have collaboration with other federal agencies. This administration has done that very well. We need to deepen it with state agencies, with cities, with counties, with regional governments and organizations, and with the private sector, the NGO community, and particularly the philanthropic community. But I would just ask, this opportunity cannot be squandered by small development, small thinking, small politics, or approaches and mythologies that say USDA cannot do this work. It may not have done so until now, but I would argue it is up to the task. The innovations that have been achieved by this committee and the department across the broader Farm Bill will all be implemented. You intend for that to occur. And the spirit should also drive this new innovation in rural development. I have no doubt at all that it is possible. I would argue the risk management tools you have given entrepreneurs in moving from a commodity payment to an insurance payment is the exact same thing you're doing in regional strategies for the counties, regions, and entrepreneurs where these farmers live and work. Now, this regional approach is so necessary for three reasons. There are longstanding structural deficits. I've talked about them to this committee many times. I want to re-mention them. They're critical as a rationale for doing this. The first is the consistent per capita disadvantage in economic and community development in federal funding. It's $300 to $500 per person per year less in rural areas. That's tens of billions of dollars. That's largely because we do not have a place entitlement in CDBG for rural non-metropolitan areas. That means multi-year funding and planning cannot occur. Finally, and I need to raise the issue, philanthropy today is investing only 1% to 3% of its total outlay in rural areas. That creates those three things, the soft infrastructure to build an innovation economy in our urban areas. These practitioners lack all of that in their work every day. As you know, I've testified many times about this, and I just would like to end with one example of how it does work. And in my testimony, I chatted about the SOAR initiative in Kentucky. House Appropriations Chair Hal Rogers and Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear came to RUPRI last fall and said, we have to do something. We've lost 7,000 mining jobs in eastern Kentucky in 3 months. Those are $80,000 a year jobs. What can we do? We're now 5 months in with an amazing regional development plan. 50 counties, cities, development organizations, private firms, the faith community, our universities, and just good Appalachian folk working on 15 different committees, doing what these folks do every day. That is simply possible. It is simply going to take, however, a little flexibility in seeking USDA to take greater lead. In different places, it will look differently. We started the journey to ask this committee to do this 10 years ago. We hosted an international conference with the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City and the OECD. There is clear international evidence that this is the way rural development is going. I would just urge you to look at the SOAR example. It is a similar example of these three great public servants, and it's occurring right now with zero federal help. The only way they were able to do that was RUPRI is funded by your committee, and they simply said, ask RUPRI to come in and start. I believe the potential is significant for where you're headed, and I commend the committee at the deepest level for moving forward with this. I think it'll be a change agent.
I want to thank you all for your excellent testimony. I'm going to turn the committee over to our ranking member, Senator Johans. I'm going to go vote, and then I'll be back. So,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me ask a question, and I think this actually is probably appropriate for any of the committee members. But I'll start with Gary, if I could. As I would travel our state over the years, there would be some communities that just, it seemed like they had it figured out. And they would build one success on another success, and all of a sudden a lot of energy was happening there. There would be other communities where they just couldn't get to that first success. Just for whatever reason. I'd like to hear your collective opinions on what do you think is a difference maker? What's driving that community that is successful, and what's holding back that community that can't seem to land that first business to create jobs or whatever it is? Gary, get us started here.
Okay. Well, I think most important, it starts with the grassroots attitude of a community. You got to believe in yourself. You got to sell what you are, not what you're not. You have to get people working together. We did that through some initiatives that we took to the ballot to allow people to decide how they wanted to spend the revenue we had as a community to try to make economic development work. One thing I've learned is don't ever sell the people short. They get it. Give them an opportunity. You can't let the naysayers get you down all the time. And then there are some even smaller tier communities that, you know, they have to get over the fact that they might be envious of what goes on a few miles down the road. But if that other community can provide the jobs and they can still take their paychecks back to those communities and keep their houses full and their schools viable, then everybody wins. And to me, that's the best regional approach there is you have to rally around and be an old farm boy. I call it the mother hen theory. You know, if the mother hen is healthy and vibrant and doing good things, all the baby chicks are going to continue to grow up and be good as well. So I think some of those communities have had to realize that maybe their niche is being a bedroom community, but being part of that regional coalition, because those communities like Sydney need those job holders too. And in our case, 40% of our workforce commutes from other communities into our economy from as far a distance away as 100 miles in every direction.
Wow. Don, do you have thoughts on that?
Senator Johan, I, I truly believe that the core of what makes the difference is just having strong leadership, and strong leadership that has an eye towards the future. And so I think just having a positive outlook and encouraging folks and supporting folks as they are trying to put ideas forward and kind of creating that can-do spirit, I think it can be contagious. It just needs to be instilled, and it really takes collective encouragement of that spirit.
Mr. Tilson?
I have to concur with it in that we have to invest in sort of the collective creative energy,
especially in the Indian country, of the young people. I think when we were looking at trying to find a distance neutral economic development opportunity, we studied several communities around the country. We looked at how did Ben and Jerry's start in Vermont, and how did Patagonia start in Portland, and how did Cabela's start in Sydney, Nebraska. And that's where we came up with the idea of why couldn't we create a national brand even where we were at? And we've proven that the model works, but we haven't got it to scale yet, and that's where we really need the help. But even just that has really energized a lot of young people. I mean, I just, the folks that we have working for us, they've never had a job where they get to use their own creativity to succeed. We've never run an ad. We run this whole company off of social media. 125,000 people a month communicate with our team just through the internet. And we're in a town of, what, 2,500 people.
Chuck?
Just two quick things, Senator. I think we need to think about the young men and women that are 15 to 30 right now. They're very, very different people than we are. I think placemaking is critical for them. It was mentioned several times. They want to stay. They're going to need some assets. I'll just tell a very, very quick story that reinforces this. When the chairman and the governor came to me, I said, let's just try to have a regional dialogue. As you all know, Appalachian Kentucky has been beaten down for a century. So we agreed to rent a school gym and just bring people together and say, what could we do together to collaborate? We had 4 weeks. We had to rent the gym at the regional university. We had over 2,000 people show up on an icy, rainy day in eastern Kentucky. 2,000 people. We should not speak down to rural folk. They get this. They want to do it. But we got to focus on that next generation of young people who want to stay at home. That's the key.
That's the key. We have, as you know, in this farm bill, we've adopted this regional approach. What we're trying to do and what we're trying to signal is that we believe the future for rural America, in part at least, is going to be a regional approach, everybody kind of working together within a region. If you were to sit down with Tom Vilsack or the Secretary for Rural Development and say, okay, here's the three things that you need to focus on implementing this program, or two things, or what would you tell them those are? What should we be looking for to make sure that they get it right as they roll out this program? And Dawn, why don't I start at your end of the table?
So I'm clear on the question, is what do we need to do to support rolling out this program?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I think I need to give it a little more thought.
Okay,
I'm
well,
sorry.
I'll come back around.
Yeah, I'd
Gary,
appreciate
you,
that.
You were taking some notes there, so.
Sure, I'll jump in. I think there has to be some skin in the game. The local communities and counties, that these programs have to be designed that unless you're a regional player, unless you're part of the team, your community and your companies aren't eligible to participate. I've been part of the regional development group for three decades, been a board member, and it's frustrating to get, a lot of times you'll see counties or communities leave the fold because they don't think regionalism is important, or they don't think communication is important. You're very familiar with the Panhandle, and you know that the base of the population is in Scottsbluff County. Well, Scottsbluff County pulls out of the regional group. What kind of a message does that send to all the other counties and the communities in the region? And until there's the incentive where the people demand it, that why aren't you part of this group? Why aren't you part of trying to find the solutions? And that you have an obligation to help all those around you. And we need to break down those old barriers. I look back to like the 1890s, late 1880s, when we probably were at our peak population out in that area of the state. We had one county. And look at the challenges we had with transportation and communication. Today, we got everything you could ask for when it comes to both. And we have 11 counties. I mean, we've just, it seems like we have to get beyond some of these imaginary lines, and we have to start thinking about the people who have to support that, and that's the taxpayers. And we have to find ways to consolidate, but do it through incentivization rather than penalty. Mm-hmm.